Hi, this is Jen Small from Chicago. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me. You should support the show like I did. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. So Penelope Spheeris directed Wayne's World. But before that, she was best known for her music documentaries. Her movie, The Decline of Western Civilization, was filmed in 1979 and 1980, and it took her deep into the mosh pit of the L.A. punk rock scene. She was up close and personal with Black Flag, The Germs, X.
I've been filming before where, you know, I've had to get out of the way because somebody's slamming into me. You know, I've gotten the black eye before. I've looked down on the floor and seen teeth that had that have been knocked out, you know. It's, it's been quite an adventure shooting this stuff.
Presumably none of that with Wayne and Garth. It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Penelope Spheeris about bringing order to the chaos of punk rock and why she was uniquely positioned to helm Wayne's World.
I think I was the only director in Hollywood that had any experience with quote-unquote headbangers, you know. and Wayne and Garth thought they were headbangers. They weren't really, don't tell anyone. But they thought they were.
Later, I'll sit down with the Sri Lankan-American singer-songwriter B. Beeman. He says winning over new audiences can be a bit of a challenge.
I have a couple things going against me. I'm, like, South Asian-looking. I'm playing acoustic guitar and singing, and as a general rule, people just don't want to see that. But I have to, like, work uphill against that.
Plus, I'll tell you about the new TV show that's putting some genuine romance into the romantic comedy genre. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. The filmmaker Penelope Spheeris contains multitudes. In the early 80s, she documented punk rock in L.A. in her film The Decline of Western Civilization. That movie's sequel followed Sunset Strip Metal. Her teased hair expertise led her to a gig directing Wayne's World. That led to a decade of studio comedies. The third Decline film, released in the late 90s, was about gutter punks, and I haven't even mentioned that she was once in charge of filming Parliament's Mothership. The three Decline of Western Civilization films are finally available on Blu-ray and DVD. Let's take a listen to a clip from the 1981 film. This is a couple of club owners trying to describe punk rock.
Punk music generally, that is hardcore punk, is characterized by its speed. It has a lot of fuzz, as musicians call it, cranked into the music. It's high volume, high speed, usually monotone volumes of vocals, characterized by protest-type lyrics.
I think a lot of the time that it gets out of hand is because of the speed of the music, which is not comfortable or normal to dance to.
Penelope Spheeris, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
When you were making that first Decline of Western Civilization movie in at the end of the 70s, 79 and 80, you were already like a genuine grown-up. You were in your 30s, and the people that you were documenting were all like 19. Was there a gulf between you and them? Like these people who were so deeply committed to this music and lifestyle, and here you are, a grown-up pointing a camera at them.
Well, I understand why one may think that could be. However, one of the great things about punk rock is, you know, if you're truly a punk, you don't care about things like that. You know, you don't care about a person's age or sexual bent or, you know, or color or those kind of things are dismissed. And so I think I was accepted as an equal at that point. Nobody ever called me an ugly old lady or anything. You may now, but not then.
Did you identify with punk rock?
Oh, totally. I totally identify with it, Jesse, because, you know, at its core, it is aggression and confusion, or I should say chaos is what it is. It's confusion as well. But the chaos, I think, is what was attractive and familiar to me because I was basically raised in chaos. And when I saw it happening, I felt at home. And in my family of four children and an alcoholic mother and seven stepfathers, there was a lot of aggression going on as well, you know. And so I thought, geez, this is what I love. And I think the reason I made the film was because I have an urge to kind of organize chaos, you know, and make sense of it. And I think that's one reason I was attracted to the subject matter.
You've alluded to the sort of chaotic family that you came from. In reading about it, it honestly seems almost like it's so insane and absurd that it wouldn't, like, you wouldn't even buy it as the premise for a TV show or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say the things I read and then maybe you can tell me about them.
Okay.
Your parents owned a traveling carnival. Your father, who had been an Olympic wrestler and was working as a strongman, died when you were a young girl. You had seven stepfathers.
Mm-hmm.
Are all of those things real?
Yeah.
That's a lot of life for,
yeah,
for 15 years or 18 years or whatever, yeah, we're covering there.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I had all that happen to me. And then my daughter's father died of a heroin overdose when she was four. And then my brother, Jimmy Spheris, who was a wonderful person and a wonderful singer-musician, died by getting hit by a drunk driver when he was 34. And then, I mean, I've had, my mom died, you know, I've had a lot of really difficult situations in my life. And somebody said one time, I'm not all that religious, but somebody said one time, God only gives you what you can handle. Okay. So I kind of live by that. And I try to turn it into something that is creative. I think pain makes you creative if you put it into the right direction. You know, some people have been hurt and been through a lot of very bad things, and they don't put it in the right direction. You know, they end up in jail or something, you know. But what I've tried to do is to turn a difficult life into something positive, you know, and I've been fortunate enough that it's worked so far.
You worked before you made the film for a time for Casablanca Records, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Casablanca Records was like the seminal disco label, and also was home to P-Funk, among other acts.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the opposite of punk rock, isn't it? Was that part of what moved you out of, like, you were just like, I got to find something that's not this?
Well, I worked at Casablanca, I think not a lot. I worked mostly for Warner Brothers Records and for CBS Records, but I did shoot Funkadelic with them. I shot four songs. I was flown to New York in about 1974 and shot, you know, George coming out in the mothership. It was actually jaw-dropping because I'd never seen anything like that or heard anything like that, you know. And it was before I did the punk movies. So, you know, I wasn't going from punk to funk. I went the other way. But I had a film company here in Los Angeles, which I believe was the first music video company here. And, you know, I shot really, really a lot of videos and knew how to shoot music at that point. And it wasn't until the late 70s that I, you know, got the idea to shoot The First Decline.
Were the things that you hear about the record industry in the late 1970s, early 1980s actual, like, you know, bathrooms with bowls of cocaine in them and things like that?
Oh, yeah. I was totally – well, I will say this, that when I was asked to go to Casablanca by Warner Brothers – somehow they were connected. I think they were distributing them or something. And they asked me to go up on Sunset Boulevard to their offices there. And I walked in and everything had like this Casablanca theme, you know, the movie with – and the guy's name was Bogart, you know, that Neil, right? Neil Bogart ran Casablanca. And I sat down in his office and he said, to his secretary, go do Penelope's nose and then we can talk. And I literally, she escorted me down the hall and we did some coke. And then I came back. And that's just how you did business, you know?
It's really like the gulf between the major label world of that time and this underground punk scene that you were documenting at the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s seems like unimaginably huge.
Yeah, I had sort of checked out of music. You know, I had a young daughter at the time. She was 4 or 5 years old. She was born in 1969, Anna Fox. And she, you know, I just had to kind of take care of her and me because her father had died from a drug overdose in 74. And it was right after that that Adam Summers from Warner Brothers said, you got to go back to work, Penelope. And that's when he went to sent me out to shoot Funkadelic. But after that, I did really a lot of music videos. And I did bands that I wasn't necessarily fans of, but I had to shoot them just to make a buck, you know, because the radio at that time was dominated by disco, like you say, Jesse. And it was, you know, you get some Doobie Brothers, you get some Seals and Crofts, and you get a lot of Bee Gees, you know. And so I kind of didn't listen to music at that point. And then one day some guy I was standing at an equipment house and he said, have you heard of the Sex Pistols? And I said, no, man, I'm not interested in music anymore. And I'd been a rock fan for my whole life. And then I went and listened to the Sex Pistols and I started going to the punk clubs. And I'm like, okay, I got to make a movie about this.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the music documentary and feature film director Penelope Spheeris, who's probably best known for her trilogy, The Decline of Western Civilization, about punk and metal music. She also directed Wayne's World. What was the first show that made an impact on you in L.A.?
I think it probably was a Germ show I saw at the Starwood, you know, and before they got kicked out of there. They couldn't play there after a while.
It's sort of a leitmotif in the movie. Just different bands listing which clubs they've been banned from.
I know. And it was true. And, you know, we had to set up special, you know, shooting sessions with, you know, Black Flag and the Germs because they couldn't play publicly anywhere in Los Angeles after a while because they'd caused so much trouble, you know. Their audiences had been a bit rowdy, as it were.
Did the trouble concern you at all?
No, because as I said, I was, you know, twice a week in my family when we were growing up, somebody got bloody, you know. I mean, it was just kind of normal life for me. So it didn't bother me. I actually liked it. It was exciting. You know, you walked into the club and your heart was pounding and it was just excitement through the roof when you were in there and you walked out and your heart was pounding because you were afraid somebody in the parking lot was going to get you. There weren't as many bouncers back then as there are now, or cops.
Were you like in the mix? Were you up front pogoing or were you at the back watching?
Well, I think you were a student noticing that there was an age difference. You know, I always, you know, I kind of quit my dancing along about the Cinnamon Cinder in Long Beach when I was 14. I always felt stupid dancing, honestly. It was too joyous for me. I'm a much more serious person. I envy people that can dance, you know, but I could never do it. I never had that much exuberance in me, you know, but I enjoyed filming them. And, you know, I know that Wayne Mayotte and his co-manager there at Club 88 like to describe it as the pogo dance, you know, but basically it was slam dancing. You know, that pogo term went away long time ago or long before I even made the movie, really. But, I mean, they use the reference in there, but it's a silly looking thing, you know. I think in England it was pogo. It was like they're jumping up and down like they're on one of those pogo sticks, you know. But over here, it was that just the pit. You know, it's the mosh pit, and it's been here ever since. I can't believe that people still are doing that. You know, it's been 30, 40 years now.
As long as we're talking about the pit, I want to play one more clip of the owner of Club 88, whose name is Wayne. Is it pronounced Mayotte?
Mayotte, yeah.
Mayotte, who's just a magical character in this film. Just an amazing dude. And he's describing the dancing. And remember, this is like 1979. And this dude is like looks like he's an insurance salesman.
Yeah.
A 60-year-old insurance.
Exactly,
salesman.
Yeah.
Wayne, can you tell me what you thought the first time you saw them dancing?
Well, to me, it was just another form of dance. It didn't really surprise me because I've been a dance fan myself for many years, and I've probably tried most types of dancing. But the pogo dance is just exactly what the name implies, is people gyrating up and down in a vertical position, as though they were, in fact, riding a pogo stick. But I can't say that I was really surprised by it.
What I loved about that moment, and actually a couple of the times that he's talking, is that here's this guy who obviously, you know, he's not part of this culture at all. I mean, he is in the sense that he owns a club where there are shows going on. But, you know, this is a 55-year-old man or something. But his description is actually accurate and sensitive. It's kind of lovely.
I know. He was going to the bank every day. You know, it's like, hey, these other club owners
that were banning everybody, they were going to the bank too. And
no,
they were like,
right.
Well, maybe we should just, you know, let's get
No,
the...
you're right. He was a sensitive guy and a very understanding. He was the kind of guy you'd like love to have. I would have loved to have had for a dad, you know. But, you know, as I've gone through the years and done these various films, I mean, the club owner in Decline 3, same kind of guy, you know, and it's like he just thinks that's what they do and it's okay. And he goes at home at night and he listens to Frank Sinatra, you know.
There are parts of the first movie that are kind of intense and disturbing. And I want to play a clip of the Germs hanging out at their house. It's through Darby Crash and Michelle Bear, who had been in the Germs and was like, I guess, I don't know if she was probably not still in the band at the point that the movie was being made, but was part of the extended universe, let's say.
Oh, yeah. She was definitely on the inner circle of that blue circle.
Yeah. And you ask them about this story, and it's a really intense story. So we can take a listen.
Tell me about the painter.
Oh, the dead painter. My parents were in China, and we were just finishing having the house painted. And Darby and Donnie and Dinky and Mark Plummer and my brother were all at my house. And my brother and I went to take the trash out at like 1 in the morning or something. And we hadn't been out in the backyard. It was on a Tuesday. We hadn't been out in the backyard since my parents left, since like the Friday before. And so anyways, I went outside, and I must have walked right over the guy because I couldn't see anything anyways. And then my brother goes to me, isn't there somebody sleeping in the backyard? And I just went, what? What are you talking about? And I went over and looked at him, and I was just joking. I went, this guy's dead. And I gave him a kick in the stomach, you know, and he was dead.
My brother thought we killed him. He goes, what should we do? Like, should we hide the body or something?
So anyways, we went and... Donnie had a camera, and we went and we lied down. I lied down next to him. We all got around him. We took a bunch of pictures, like family pictures, and we're all going, hi, you know, and taking pictures and stuff.
What really happened to the guy?
They think he had a heart attack and fell off the ladder, and no one found him for a few days.
It was really funny, actually. And the paramedics came, and they were joking with us, and the coroner came.
Oh, you remember all those jokes?
Oh, yeah. What were
Instead
some of the
John
jokes?
Doe, they put down Jose Doe because it was a...
Didn't you feel bad that the guy was dead?
No, not at all, because I hate painters.
That's your voice. You're behind the camera there.
Mm-hmm. Pretty funny story, though, huh? The painter story? It's famous.
Yes and no.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? I mean, the guy's dead. What are you going to do? And it's like...
I mean, it's sort of intense. Like there's two things going on there as I hear it, right? One is this relationship to death, right? That these really young people are just like, well, that's their attitude.
Mm-hmm.
The other is a kind of gross and adolescent, but just gross overall classism and racism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, honestly, like the slur is sort of one thing, And I imagine by the time this is on the radio, we'll probably beep that out. But, you know, the slur is one thing. But just like I hate painters, it's just like that hit me almost harder.
Mm-hmm. You really like painters? Sorry, man. If it was a plumber, you wouldn't have felt so bad. No. Yeah, well, here's the way I look at it, Jesse. I didn't say those things. They did. So I put them up on the screen, and what I try to do is present them in an objective way and let the viewer decide how they feel about it. And I think you're correct in that it does bring out a lot of emotion, you know? But that's what makes a good movie.
After a break, I'll finish my conversation with Penelope Spheeris. We'll talk about her work with hair metal bands like Kiss, Aerosmith, and the slightly less well-known Odin, and how that opened the door to her directing Wayne's World. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Did you know Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals, or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hey, everyone. We're the Flophouse, one of the newest additions to the Maximum Fun podcasting network. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. What is the Flophouse, you may very well ask?
We watch a bad movie, and then we talk about it.
A bad movie podcast? Isn't that like every fifth podcast on the internet?
I'd answer that by saying, one, we've been doing this show for over 7 years, long before the entire premise of our show was a cliche. And two, shut up.
Sick burn.
I'd say that our show is more of a comedy podcast. A podcast about words that sound like other words. A podcast about me singing long, irritating songs like this one. A podcast about pitches for a Ziggy comic book movie. Or discussions about sex tarps.
Yeah, I mean, mostly it's a show about three friends just hanging out. And talking about ding-dongs.
That's mostly used to.
Wait, what?
So if you like any of those things, subscribe in iTunes today or visit MaximumFun.org to follow the show.
The Flophouse.
Woo! It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the director Penelope Spheeris. She's behind the documentary trilogy The Decline of Western Civilization. All three of the movies are now available together in a brand new box set. How much did you identify with the subjects of The Decline of Western Civilization 2, which was about metal and especially sort of Sunset Strip hair metal, though not exclusively?
Well, I often tell the story of having been asked by this guy David Jablin and Harry Shearer if I wanted to direct this film they were going to do about metal called Spinal Tap. And, you know, I thought, no, I really can't do that, you guys, because I really love this music so much that I can't make fun of it. And that was really dumb of me, because that was a really cool movie. But, you know, I turned down a lot of really cool movies in my career, actually. But I guess other people were meant to do them, so that was fine. I related to the people in Decline to, I don't know, I guess let's just put it this way, Jesse. I wrote a lot of different kinds of trends during my upbringing and my psychological development, you know. And at that point, I was kind of into the, I was definitely into the metal music. I would go to the clubs relentlessly. And I, you know, my daughter was going to clubs at that point too. She was 17 years old. She worked on Decline 2 with us. And I kind of regret bringing her to the clubs because she still goes and she takes her daughter to the clubs, and it's almost like the club disease is in our family, you know. But I don't know. It's a good form of entertainment as long as you go to safe places, you know. But yeah, there was a lot of sexism there, more so than I think in the first Decline in with the punk kids, you know, a lot more. But I really never, you know, suffered from it in any way because, you know, I wasn't one of those sexy chicks, you know. Like, there were too many other good-looking girls around that they could hassle, so they didn't hassle me, you know. I'm just like the ugly chick behind the camera. It was a fun time, though. It really was.
I'm not a metal dude, and don't think that in watching the film I expected to be so charmed by those dudes.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. I mean, I'm flattered by that, because my favorite filmmaker, the documentarian anyway, is Frederick Weissman. And the way Weissman shot, and I watched all of his movies when I was at UCLA Film School, is that he just turned the camera on, and whatever happened in front of that camera, he just gave it to the audience and let them think about it the way they wanted. You know, he was very objective. And that's what I tried to do, just to present it and let the audience interpret it. You're trying to offer some sort of insight, or, you know, present something that people haven't seen before. And that's all I was trying to do, you know.
I want to play a clip from The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. And in this clip, Penelope Spheris, my guest, is asking if the guys in the bands have jobs.
When's the last time you had a job?
Well, this is my job. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this is what I do. And I believe in it. You know, this is rock and roll. I do this. So, I mean, I don't consider that I'm like lazy or something, or that I don't do a job, because I bust my ass doing rock and roll.
Do you always have money?
No. Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't.
We're in debt for $100,000.
Right now, yes, we are. But we're getting out of that.
How could you be in debt for $100,000?
We bought a lot of equipment.
Our last album we did was financed by this guy who's in jail right now.
Yeah.
But now he wants his money.
There's a lot of pathos in these guys. You know, I mean, there's guys who are monstrously successful in the movie. You know, you interviewed Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, and you interview Lemmy, and it's a different scale of success, but more credible on the second one. You interview some huge rock stars, Poison. But then a lot of these dudes, you know, one of the bands that's featured in the movie is a band called Odin. You know, they don't even have a Wikipedia page, you know. And to watch them do something as, like, absurdly grand as be in a Sunset Strip hair metal band, which is like the most absurdly grand thing you can do in the context of American pop music, probably, right? And just think, wow, like, this kind of presentational success is everything to them. And one day they're going to be 31. And they're probably not going to be Aerosmith, you know?
Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. I think they were just speaking the mind of the collective consciousness of the time, you know? And even Muhammad Ali at that time was saying things like, if I just think I'm going to make it and win, I'm going to win. And if you think you're going to win, you're going to win. And that was just the way that people thought at that time. And now, in retrospect, it doesn't happen. You can't just think it and make it happen.
Now we understand you have to put it on a vision board.
There you go. And be on Wiki.
I want to play another clip from The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2. And this is a bunch of members of various bands in a montage talking about how they get by without money.
It's kind of a rule that chicks don't get in the house unless they have a sack of groceries with them, you know.
And let me tell you, when your stomach's growling, you haven't had anything for a couple days, you don't, all of a sudden your moral value is just sort of like, okay, hon, if you want to pay for dinner, that's fine with me.
You know, a lot of guys in this scene let girls take care of them financially. What do you think about that?
I think that's sad.
Sounds horrible. And in a sense, it's a form of prostitution.
Would you ever go out with a girl just so that she would, you know, pay for some food, whether if you didn't like her?
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that prostitution?
No. I wouldn't see it that way.
No.
I don't see it that way. No.
Would you let some guy pay for you?
No.
What are you going to do for them?
Anything they want right now that I can do.
What do you do for them?
You know, when I have a little money, I'll buy them the nice things, the pretty furs and the cars and the Rolls Royces and the whole shebang.
You're going to remember them.
Oh, yeah.
Something that comes through in both of the first two of these movies is that there a lot of these musicians are basically living the lives of boys while women around them who are not older than them are taking care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something you were thinking about as you were shooting the movies?
Oh, it was very obvious that that was what was going on. Nobody was putting a gun to their head, the women's heads, and saying, you know, buy me dinner. They were doing it because they had the money. They were probably working as waitresses or whatever, you know, or not any high-paying jobs, really. I mean, basically, the kids in the movie were just having a lot of fun, you know. And to me, the late 80s was Caligula. It was the age of total indulgence and total experimentation with every kind of, you know, just self-satisfying thing that you could think of. You know, it was the epitome of sex, drugs, and rock and roll that time.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the director Penelope Spheeris. Her documentaries featuring the worlds of late 1970s punk, late 1980s heavy metal, and 90s gutter punks are known collectively as The Decline of Western Civilization. She also directed a little movie you might have heard of called Wayne's World. Was the fact that you had directed that movie at play when you were trying to get the gig to direct Wayne's World?
Oh, yes. Yes. Very astute on your part, Jesse. Definitely. I think I was the only director in Hollywood that had any experience with, quote unquote, headbangers, you know. and Wayne and Garth thought they were headbangers. They weren't really. Don't tell anyone. But they thought they were. And I had a previous working relationship with Lorne Michaels from the early 70s. And Lorne had always promised me that I could direct some of the short films on Saturday Night Live, but he never let me do it.
You had produced the Albert Brooks movies in the first season of Saturday
Yes.
Night Live, the Albert Brooks
and
shorts.
Lorne called me one day and said, I got this really funny guy, but he doesn't know how to make movies, and you do, so will you show him how to make movies? And I'm like, sure, if I can just get a gig and pay the rent. So I taught Albert how to make movies, and I think he did very, very well.
He's done okay.
And then he taught me a lot about being funny, although I had worked with Richard Pryor before that, and he taught me a lot about being funny, too. And it was an even exchange. He taught me a lot about Hollywood, because I'm a girl, you know, from Trailer Park out in Orange County. I don't know anything about Hollywood, you know.
And meanwhile, Johnny Carson had talked about Albert Brooks on The Tonight Show when Albert Brooks was 16 years old.
Did he really?
Yeah, totally. Wow. I met this kid named Albert Einstein at a party. It was really hilarious.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Johnny had good taste.
The thing that I think connects, above and beyond just the mere fact that Wayne and Garth from Wayne's World are aspiring suburban headbangers, the thing in my mind that connects them to the characters in Decline 2 is that Wayne and Garth capture the real sweetness and sort of the dreams, like the hope of those kids in Decline, you know, those guys that whose bands are probably not going to go anywhere, but who just want to, like, live this beautiful slash awful life, you know?
Yeah.
Like this perfect dream of what an 18-year-old boy would think a ultimate life would be.
You know, I think what I've noticed is the older you get, the more difficult it is to be on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, the more difficult it is to be optimistic. And when you see someone being that optimistic about life, it's so engaging, and you just want to embrace them and go, yes, I want to think that way. I want to think life is so beautiful. I want to be that way. And I think that, yeah, you're right. That's what people loved about Wayne and Garth. They were just so optimistic, you know.
I want to play a clip from Wayne's World, and my guest is Penelope Spheeris, who directed the film. And so, I mean, if you haven't seen Wayne's World, get your act together.
No.
But in this scene, Wayne and Garth are hanging out together. They're lying on the hood of the car and staring up at the sky as airplanes pass over them.
Sometimes I wish I could boldly go where no man's gone before. But I'll probably stay in Aurora. What are you thinking about?
Cassandra. She's a fox. In France, she would be called La Renard, and she would be hunted with only her cunning to protect her.
She's a babe.
She's a robo-babe. In Latin, she would be called Babia Majora.
If she were a president, she'd be Babraham Lincoln. Did you ever find Bugs Bunny attractive when he'd put on a dress and play a girl bunny?
No. No.
Neither did I. I was just asking.
That's such a, I mean, there's so much funny stuff in Wayne. I mean, the Wayne's World's, I watched it maybe a year ago, and I laughed straight through just like I did when it came out in theaters when I was 12. But I think that scene is so sweet. It's so lovely, above and beyond just being, there's a few really killer jokes in there. But it's about how, like, how much these guys love each other and just want something nice to happen in their lives.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's ironic that you would pick that scene because we didn't talk about what clips you were going to use here on your show. That's my favorite scene in Wayne's World. Whenever anybody asks me what scene do I like the best, it's that one. And it was filmed on the last day of the shoot. It was a 34-day shoot, mostly on a Paramount lot. And they were so tired. And we were working so late. And we had to stuff them into a limo to get them out the door to go to the airport to go back and write on Saturday Night Live. And we were really under the gun to get it done. And the reason there's that long gap in there is because I just kept rolling the camera. I didn't say cut. And they started improvising. And that's when they started laughing for real. And I think that's what helps give it the charm that it has, you know, because it was so spontaneous. But they were, yeah, they were making it up at that point.
I read this New York Times profile of you from like a few months after Wayne's World had come out. It was already a huge hit. And you talked about how much you pursued the job. What did you think you had to offer to these two sketch comedy guys, especially, you know, these two guys who had created these goofy 3-minute characters for Saturday Night Live?
Well, I think what I had to offer was that I really knew kind of a lot about comedy because when I was growing up, that was our only escape, was to take Coke bottles in and get a nickel a piece for him or whatever it was back then and get 50 cents so that we could go to the movies. And every Saturday and every Sunday, I took my brothers and sisters to the movies and we watched mostly comedies. And I really felt like I kind of honed my craft by the time I was 15. I really knew comedy. And then when I went to school and learned the technique, you know, the technical aspects, and then ran into Richard Pryor one day on the UCLA campus, and then, you know, having worked with Albert Brooks and Danny DeVito and Lily Tomlin, I had all these comedians in my path for some reason. And so I was pretty well prepped, I think, to get the comedy right there. Plus, I had that heavy metal thing in my back pocket. It was just, honestly, Jesse, it was unpredictable kind of magical meeting of chemistries. You know, everybody was shocked that it did as well as it did. Lorne didn't think it would. The studio didn't think it would. I didn't. Mike didn't. Dana didn't. It's crazy that it happened, you know?
I think I accounted for like $10 million in ticket sales.
Well, good for you. Thank you very much. That's sweet.
Well, Penelope, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was great to get to talk to you.
I so appreciate your having me here and hope that people will watch the Decline DVDs now that they're out.
Penelope Spheeris is the director of the trilogy of Decline of Western Civilization movies, which after many years of VHS to DVD bootlegging are finally available with huge amounts of extra material produced by Penelope and her daughter Anna on DVD and Blu-ray from Shout Factory. Now, after a break, I'll sit down with the folk musician, B. Beeman. His new album of folk rock is loosely themed around the immigrant experience, but it isn't as earnest as all of that sounds. He's got kind of a Randy Newman thing going on, too. He'll explain. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Did you know Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hello, buddies. I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Andy Bolt.
And we're the host of Bunker Buddies.
We're a podcast where we're amateur survivalists and we talk about things like the apocalypse.
And we talk about zombies and preparedness.
What are you going to wear when it's the apocalypse?
And you have no idea if you don't listen to our show. It comes out every Wednesdays on MaximumFun.org and on iTunes. Sometimes we try weird foods or we talk about where to camp or how to avoid getting eaten or any of these things.
Yeah, so listen to us because it might just save your life.
We'll see you in the bunker.
Bye.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. B. Beeman taught himself to sing when he was a teenager. He wasn't playing with bands. He was singing along to his car radio. He'd drive around his native St. Louis, singing with Ray Charles and Sam Cooke. By the time he'd grown up and moved to San Francisco, he was a singer-songwriter, a little Woody Guthrie, a little Randy Newman. But he's more than just acoustic guitars. On his new album, Rhythm and Reason, he indulges his soulful side. Here's a bit of the album's first track, Moving to Brussels. B. Beeman, it's great to have you on Bullseye. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, like, every bit of promotional copy about you that has a date on it that's, like, 2014 or before says something about, like, a dude with an acoustic guitar, like either Woody Guthrie or Bob Dylan or whatever. And I put on this record, it's like you're, like, making, like, Chairman of the Board songs.
Yeah, I mean, I love all kinds of music. I've always loved all kinds of music. But when you're putting out an album, it has to be focused in some way. And my focus for this one was more of my R&B and soul singer influences, whereas my previous stuff had maybe been more traditional singer-songwriter stuff. Not exactly, but the presentation was on acoustic guitar and me singing and some peripheral instrumentation besides that, but yeah, that one was more focused towards quote unquote Americana music, and this one's, like I said, more R&B.
B, I know you brought a guitar with you. Would you like to sing a song?
Sure. I'm going to play a song off my new record, and it's a song about being interrogated by your lover as to where you've been and what you've been up to and who you've been with, and it's a song called Waterboarded in Love.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. This is B. Beeman.
stop trying to put the flame out. I'm waterboarded. Yeah, I'm waterboarded. Strap me to the table. I'm soggy like tomato. Yeah, it's complicated.
B. Beeman on Bullseye with Waterboarded in Love from his new album Rhythm and Reason. So it's a little bit cheeky to name your song Waterboarded in Love, B. How did that come about?
Anytime I have like a ridiculous chorus in my song, it's because it's sort of what came naturally. And it's something I always realize that it is cheeky. That isn't always a good thing, but if it sticks and it I've worked on it, I keep working on the song, and that seems to be what fits best, and that's the sentiment is summing up the musicality of it as well. I just stick with it, and this one just seemed too good to pass up because a lot of songs have been written about love is torture or being tortured in love, essentially, and I'm just kind of taking the next Randy Newman step, you might say.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the folk musician B. Beeman. His new record is called Rhythm and Reason. I read an interview where you talked about as a teenager listening to the Randy Newman song Rednecks.
Mm-hmm.
Rednecks is a song that is written from the perspective of a somewhat provincial Southern racist. Mm-hmm. That is a satire both of Southern racism and of, it's a very clever.
The Northern superiority.
Exactly. It's a very clever satire of, the kind of blitheness and racism of Northern superiority. What led you to that song as a teenager?
I think my friend Sam Rosenfeld, who is always much hipper than me, with music, turned me on to him and Warren Zevon. And Zevon has this song called Excitable Boy, which is not fit for family airtime, but Newman just, he was so bored with everything, I guess, or some whatever drove him to do that. He went for it. And, that opened the possibilities of satirical music. It wasn't, that wasn't like that one guy, the political guy who had that show, who would play piano and be
talking about
really,
Mark Russell?
I think so.
Yeah, he was saying, Congress is the opposite of progress.
Right. Yeah, that's not my kind of satire at all. So, that opened a lot of doors in terms of possibilities of what your lyrics could be about, what stories you could tell. And I certainly grasped that.
I imagine there's a certain amount of expectation, particularly in the world of folk music and singer-songwriter music, of a kind of self-revelatory earnestness.
Mm-hmm.
And then it might get you into trouble if you don't like open your set by saying or introduce a song by saying, just so you know, this song is written in character. This is a little bit about the character that I, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. It can get you in trouble. You can't just like go right into it. If I'm playing for somebody who's never heard me and doesn't know who I am, I try to sing something that's not, so I wouldn't sing Waterboarded in Love right off the bat, but I would get their attention with my vocals and my voice, because people seem to respond to that. And I have a couple things going against me. I'm like South Asian looking. I'm playing acoustic guitar and singing, and as a general rule, people just don't want to see that. But I have to like fight up. I have to work uphill against that. You know, a German immigrant could come here, and then their son could take up folk music, and everybody would accept them perfectly. But I just look the way I look, and it's a little different for everybody. So I have to kind of go at it at a different angle. Each night, really, the audience is different. I have to kind of figure them out before they figure me out.
Let's hear another song from Bee Beeman's new album, Rhythm and Reason. This track is called Bread and Butter. I feel like there are a lot of themes on this album about hard work. And I wonder if that has some connection to your parents' roots in the immigrant experience, which is so often about committing to a life of extraordinarily hard work.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's about the overarching theme of the record. You might say a concept album, but it's not quite that, but it has a theme to it. It's about immigrants and the forces pushing and pulling them. And yeah, it is about hard work. I mean, when you come here as an immigrant, you start from nothing, basically, and you work to have a comfortable life for your children, and then your children have a better life. But yeah, it's all rooted in hard work, because the people who are determined enough to travel the distance and do everything that it takes to emigrate and immigrate, they're just wired for hard work, and they just have tunnel vision for the most part, trying to get their children into better situation. So I definitely grew up with that, seeing that in my household, and I wanted to pay tribute to those people's lives and that story, because it's not necessarily heard all that often, even though this country is made up of immigrants. The album is mainly talking about that first wave of immigration and that experience. And the first song is called Move Into Brussels on the record. The next song is called There Goes a Neighborhood, because that's kind of like the reaction to them coming into town. And Bread and Butter is the third song, and that's about having to persevere in the face of whatever might come, and putting your nose down and getting to work. So, yeah, every single song on the record has something to do with an immigrant experience, some in very focused ways, some in more abstract ways.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of There Goes the Neighborhood from Bee Beeman's new record, Rhythm and Reason. It's such an enchanting song. I mean, it's like it could play in a Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville restaurant and nobody would complain to their waiter. You know what I mean?
That's kind of an insult, but a compliment at the same time. But,
not at all. I mean, it's a really lovely song. And it's like it seems strikes me as a very specific choice to write a song like that from a perspective that you don't care for personally, and yet try very hard to make it something that would that seduces the listener.
Yeah, I mean, that's I'm not all you need is love kind of guy necessarily. I don't believe that kind of song will change anybody's mind. I'm trying to change people's minds. I'm not exactly sure I'm going to, but I do know that people can be tricked into thinking certain things, and I'm doing my best to trick people and see the other side of the coin. And, you know, because I'm always thinking about what the other person is thinking and how they're viewing the situation and whether they're right or wrong. But I'm trying to think of why they think those things. And, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to change everybody's mind, but I like to, you know, to give people their medicine with a spoonful of sugar, I guess you'd say.
B, do you want to sing another song?
Yeah, I'll play Up in Arms. I mean, that would be a perfect segue right there.
Sounds fantastic. This is B. Beeman, and he's going to sing Up in Arms from his new record, Rhythm and Reason.
Great. Thank you.
I was once at the forefront of the movement, teaching my brothers, teaching sisters of their pride. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I said. Ain't but two things have changed. It's safe to say I've had a price upon my head. Bobby Seale and I have made important progress. It's safe to say that my glory has fled. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I said, here comes the baddest man your eyes have ever graced. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I say. Politicians never see the brown boys starving, like Malcolm X and Martin King and Marcus Garvey. Yeah. In 65 there was a climate for the riots, and it's 89 and I'm seeing deja vu again. The police always saying, why the senseless violence? But they'll light the spark and we'll be dry brush and the wind. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I say. Tell Bobby Hutton that policeman still gets paid. Up
find some place where I can sleep. My pillow's debts I've left unpaid on these West Oakland streets. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I say. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I say.
Beeman with Up in Arms from his album Rhythm and Reason. That's a song written from the perspective of Huey Newton, right?
Correct. Yeah, his like final minutes of his life, yeah.
What was interesting to you about the last moments of Huey Newton's life rather than the height of his activism in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, I was very interested in black power as a teenager, an angsty teenager. Never militant, but I was into MLK and read Malcolm X's autobiography, and Huey Newton was a polarizing figure that I was very interested in. And by the time I knew about him, he had died already. But the reason why I wrote it from that perspective, those final hours, is that he had this fulcrum in his life, and he had dropped all the way back down to the bottom. And I firmly believe that nonviolent protest is the way forward, and you know, violence is met with violence, no matter how right you are or how pushed into a corner you are. Especially in this country, violence is met with violence, and it's just going to create more anger and more problems for you and people involved. And I think him telling that story at the end of his life, after he had, you know, seen the failure of his ways, you know, has a power to it and has a meaning and a sort of a fable aspect to it that I wanted to tell.
Well, B.B. Beeman, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was great to get to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I know you have bigger fish to fry, but I'm glad you fried this one.
That's a very tortured metaphor, B. B. Beeman. His new record is called Rhythm and Reason. He's playing a few more dates around the U.S. later this summer. You can find those at bbeeman.com, bhibhiman.com. Every week we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, the host. It's called The Outshot. What does it mean to be romantic as a grown-up? Basically, there have been two romantic stories in entertainment in the last few years. One is like this spectacularly beautiful woman who got caught up in something. It's almost always work. And then she realizes, oh my gosh, I gotta find a man. And then she falls over a lot, because she wouldn't be relatable if she didn't fall over a lot. And then the guy is pretty much perfect, except she can't tell at first. And then she does. She figures it out. And a lot of times he convinces her by acting like a weirdo stalker. And then the other type is basically a dude who just won't grow up. And he has to learn that there's more to life than video games, like adult friendships and maybe he should even think about women like they were human beings, and so on and so forth. And I sound snide, but I'm not exactly completely against those stories. I mean, Knocked Up is totally great. And one time on a plane, I watched a Hugh Grant movie called Music and Lyrics. And honestly, I kind of liked it. But those same stories kind of get old after a while. Which actually reminds me, what about those of us who are getting old? I'm not talking about elderly old, just older than young. I'm 34, but I've been a grown-up for quite a while, and I don't own any bongs, and the lady in my life pretty much never falls over. So what about us grown-ups with actual lives? Do we get to be romantic? That's the question that the new TV show Catastrophe asks. What does romance mean when you're a fully formed adult human being? Can you even have a romantic comedy that stars people with actual real-life seeming problems and lives and identities that aren't defined by their relationships?
That was my friend. That was just my friend Dave texting to invite me over tonight.
Aw, you don't have any friends.
I've changed. I have friends now. I'm putting down roots. Who knows? Your brother and I might hit it off and be friends, too. We might be better than friends. Be more like brothers.
Well, that would make you my brother.
Aye. Love doesn't follow rules.
I don't love you.
The setup of Catastrophe is a bit like Knocked Up. An American businessman is visiting London, and he has what we will, for purposes of the radio, describe as a six-night stand with a woman that he meets in a bar. And then he goes home to the States, and a few months later, he's on a date, and he gets a call. That lady from England is pregnant, so he moves there to be a dad. The stars of the show are the creators of the show, the very funny American stand-up Rob Delaney and the totally brilliant Sharon Horgan. They're both more like 40 than 25, and from the first episode, they feel like actual adult human beings. There are no man-children. There's no clumsy, whoopsie tumbles. These are actual people. And what's more, they seem to like each other, actually.
I want you to know that I'm going to look back on my time with you and remember you as an extraordinarily good-smelling woman with a magical ass, and you're smart, so you could even get away with being less attractive, and you'd still be fairly attractive.
Wow, okay. I'll remember you as a sturdy lovemaker with a massive chin who was really kind to waiters and taxi drivers, which suggests you might actually be a good person.
It's not that they're perfect. They're actually both kind of a mess. And they're funny and scared, and they made a lot of mistakes. But they're not totally dissolute, and they're not aimless. They're just people who didn't expect to be having a baby. People who are trying to figure out how to fall in love when there are a lot of, you know, demands on their lives.
I could work anywhere in Boston. Everyone in advertising knows me there.
I don't want to live in Boston.
Why not?
Because it's Boston. I mean, once you graduate to a place like London or New York, you don't regress to Boston. What's even there? And, you know, my family's here, my job, my friends.
Yeah, I had all that, too. And now I don't even have a job here anymore. And do you think our baby would like to eat, for example? Because I'd like to be able to buy it food. And I was issued a very specific work visa, not a sit-around-on-a-couch visa.
Yeah, okay. It's terrifying. But, you know, just take a minute. Don't go making crazy decisions for us. I will help you. And we'll sort it out, but we have to sort it out here. And, you know, I mean, just to be practical, you can't fly when you're this pregnant.
Isn't that just the last trimester?
You can't fly to Boston at any point during your pregnancy.
My wife and I like to watch Catastrophe together and hold hands. It's nice to watch grown-ups fall in love. That's my outshot. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Senior producer at Maximum Fun is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our thanks this week to Ashley Ann Krigbaum at KALW in San Francisco for her engineering help. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org, click on Shows, and then Bullseye, or open up your favorite podcasting software and search for Bullseye. You can listen to all of our past shows there or SoundCloud. So there's some great ways to listen to Bullseye. I think you should. And if you want to hear about more cool culture stuff between now and the next time Bullseye's on the air, you can check out our sister show, Pop Rocket. It's a roundtable discussion of everything great in popular culture, hosted by Guy Branum, who's a brilliant comedian. This week, yours truly joins the Pop Rocket team. What can I say? Someone couldn't show up. Someone wasn't there. We talk about TV shows, films, and musicians who've jumped the shark. It was a lot of fun. I got to shout at one of our panelists, Winter Mitchell. She can take it. She's a big girl. It was a blast. It is such a fun show. I really think you should check it out. Anyway, I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.